Third case for oral argument this morning is the South Dakota Real Estate Commission Appellant versus Sherry St. Pierre Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Robert C. Ryder Jr., an attorney from Pierre. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Kenneth Barker, an attorney from Belle Fouche. Justice Conan Camp has disqualified himself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Lawrence Long, a circuit judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Conan Camp's place. Mr. Ryder, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and justices of the court, and acting Justice Doug Long. Bob Ryder, I'm a lawyer in Pierre, and Lindsay Ryder Rapp, who's in the courtroom, and I represented the South Dakota Real Estate Commission in this proceeding. Counsel, this is a proceeding that originated in an administrative appeal. The South Dakota Real Estate Commission commenced proceedings against Sherry St. Pierre. She is the licensee of the commission. The hearing was held before the administrative law judge, Hillary Brady, who rendered her proposed decision, which was then submitted to the full commission. They adopted her findings and conclusions, modified slightly her proposed decision on discipline so as to impose the discipline that they believed was appropriate. And the discipline imposed was some education and a period of time that she was going to be on suspension. The discipline imposed actually was that her license was suspended for a period of time. The suspension was held in abeyance pending her completion of education and also payment of certain costs and expenses. That decision was appealed by the licensee to the circuit court. The circuit court and Judge Eklund in Rapid City reversed, and we appealed from Judge Eklund's decision. The standard of review in this case, as the court is well aware, is that this court will give great weight to the agency finding.
Do we give any weight to the circuit court?
No.
So it's straight de novo?
Yes.
Okay.
Only when the agency decision is clearly erroneous will this court reverse the agency, particularly in this case where the agency heard the testimony, and I say particularly not just the Real Estate Commission, but more particularly Judge Brady, heard the testimony and reviewed the records and was able to determine the credibility, because credibility in this case is very important.
So this is not a case where you have a lot of deposition testimony?
Correct. The only testimony that would have been other than directly presented was there was a tape recording of an interview that was held with Ms. St. Pierre before this even began. It was held between she and the managing broker of the firm. That's the only thing other than testimony directly from the stand. The question is, under the statute, was her conduct such as to constitute dishonesty within or without the pursuit of the licensee's license privilege? And the statute says within or without. So the question really is was there a dishonesty by way of her conduct in this matter? Her own testimony affirms that. When Mr. Barker asked her a question during his case in chief, he asked her, "Do you feel that you were dishonest in any regard?" And she replied that yes. Shouldn't say yes, she said, "I was dishonest with Matt Konenkamp," and Matt was her managing broker at the time. So her own testimony, we suggest to the court and submit to the court, is binding upon her and really resolves the question presented today. Interestingly enough, when Judge Eklund rendered his decision, he reversed on the question of dishonesty, but didn't discuss that in his decision. What he discussed in the decision was whether her conduct was fraudulent. And his perspective, I would argue, was that you have to show harm from fraudulent conduct and that it wasn't harm shown by way of a financial or monetary harm. Matt Konenkamp established a compliance staff at the business that he was on the ground for. And part of the compliance staff was to ensure that the people within the agency acted in a proper manner and acted in a manner that he deemed appropriate. One of the things he established early on was don't be signing other people's names, not even Bob Ryder, power of attorney for Lindsay Ryder. You don't do that. If clients are signing documents, they sign them themselves. He made that perfectly clear. Ms. St. Pierre knew that, she wasn't supposed to be signing someone else's name. So it was clear the office policy required that. And in this particular case, Ms. St. Pierre signed the names of the three sellers that she was representing. Not only did she sign the names of the sellers, but she used whiteout at the end of one of the signatures to make it appear more like it had actually been signed by one of the individual sellers.
Wasn't that the one that was crumpled up in the wastebasket, though?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The whiteout, that was crumpled up in a wastebasket, wasn't it?
Right.
So how is that actually used to make it look like?
I'm sorry. What she did is she took that paper, signed it, and then she made a copy of it and submitted it. Because two of the sellers lived in California, so she'd been dealing with them by way of faxing. And so she signed up, threw it in the wastebasket, presented the signature on a copy that she had made. That's my recollection, Your Honor. And if that was just an example, I think that's accurate, Your Honor. And that was one of the issues that was raised was when she first was confronted with this, she said, why isn't there fax information on it? And she said the reason there wasn't any fax information was because she'd emailed it to the people in California. And there's a tape that you folks have as part of the record that will confirm that. Now, that's my recollection from listening to the tape. Ultimately, when she was confronted, she admitted, yes, she had signed their names. And that was after she'd already submitted it to the compliance staff. The compliance staff looked at it. They were concerned. They didn't think it looked like the signatures of the sellers because they'd seen the signatures of the sellers before. So
The facts were question of whether or not she had authority from the clients, and I think there's an argument that she did have authority. There may be an issue of whether or not it was before or after the fact. Is that correct?
Your Honor, Justice, her testimony was, and the testimony, frankly, of other witnesses that she called, was that Mr. Pagan said she could sign for him. Mr. Pagan said he had authority for Mr. Huffman, one of the other sellers, to represent him. He indicated, he confirmed he had no authority for Mrs. Huffman, whose name she also signed. After the fact, she went out and did get something signed by all three of them saying it was okay to sign for it. But that's the gravamen of the issue presented really isn't whether she did or didn't have authority. From our perspective, it is whether she represented that this document had been signed by these sellers when she turned it back into the compliance staff. And we suggest, not only suggest, we submit that the evidence was clear that she did make that representation, that she said, here it is. She didn't say, I signed on behalf of them. She represented the document as she presented it to the compliance staff as having been signed by the individuals. So that misrepresentation is really the issue involved, and is that consistent with her professional responsibility?
Well, the circuit court was more focused on actual authority, or they were looking at the circuit court looked at that question. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the circuit court looked more at the question of actual authority and looked at harm. He referenced some jury instructions where, you know, what harm was created by this. And our argument to that court was this is a question of professional responsibility. There doesn't have to be harm. I think this court in the Leonard case confirmed that. Harm goes to the degree of what type of discipline is imposed. But if you violate your professional responsibility, that you have an obligation, and this court's recognized, not only to your managing broker, but more particularly to the public.
All right. Well, Mr. Ryder, the professional responsibility, as I understand in this case, was not based on an agency or administrative violation or statutory violation. It was a violation of company policy. So does violation of a company policy raise to the level of dishonesty to be handled by the board. Isn't that the issue in this case?
That is the issue that Ms. St. Pierre has suggested.
But well, isn't that what also the trial court found?
I think the trial court focused on that issue. But the issue is not violation of company policy. When you're signing someone else's name, they say this was an inconsequential document. And so who cares if they sign, she signed someone else's name? But the point is that she was dishonest within or without the pursuit of her license privileges. Mr. Koninkamp, under the statutory obligation as the managing broker, he is responsible for the individuals that work under him. And he is responsible for what she does. She signed the name of someone in a document perhaps of limited consequence, but if she signed it in that case, who is to say that she might not sign it in other cases where there is more consequence? So really the issue is, was she dishonest in her dealings? And I argue, Your Honor, and submit that her own admission was that she was dishonest. And how can she claim that a material issue of fact where she admitted, how can she now claim that there's a contrary, should be a contrary finding on that? And this court has held on numerous occasions that a party is bound by their own testimony, bound by their own admission. And in this case, certainly she is. She can't disregard that. She said herself that she was dishonest in her dealings with Mr. Koninkamp. And that, in and of itself, standing alone, frankly, is sufficient enough to confirm that she violated her professional responsibilities. And I hope I answered the question about Justice Everson. I hope I answered your question about within or without, or more particularly, if it was just a circumstance where it was company policy. Because they are, I'm sorry.
Then do we get to a point that the board has to weigh it? Is any violation of any company policy, is there a degree, or is it any violation of any company policy that involved dishonesty significant enough for board action?
Justice, I submit that the way the statute is written, the dishonesty doesn't even have to relate to company policy, doesn't have to relate to acting as a broker. Dishonest conduct in other areas of your life under that statute, because it says within or without your professional licensure, dishonest conduct is something that the Real Estate Commission has not only the opportunity, but more particularly the responsibility to see that people who practice in that area are honest people, and that they treat others in their relationships in an honest manner, not a dishonest manner. These people that she was treating in a dishonest manner were the compliance staff. These were the people who said, we believe this document's necessary. And she went ahead and signed somebody else's name to it, knowing that she was not supposed to do that, but doing it anyway because her testimony was she knew she'd get her commission anyway, but the argument from the tape, the recording that you have, is that, well, she wanted that earlier than late, rather than later, and number one, and number two, that the sellers that she was representing, they didn't want to be bothered anymore by signing any more documents. And what happened is that she didn't know Huffman's were even sellers. She didn't know they even owned the property until like a day before the closing, and then she was hustling around trying to fax stuff out to California to get their signature. I'm not complaining about that. I'm just saying her relationship with them was different than the relationship with Mr. Pagan. So I go back to the Leonard case, which is a recent case from this court. And as I indicated, in Leonard, this court said the question is whether the licensee violated her professional responsibility. And the lower court focused on, was there a harm that resulted from it? And really the only harm that you could directly say would have been the fact that she got her commission check earlier than she might otherwise have got it, but she had earned it. I'm not arguing that she didn't earn it. But more principally, and the real issue, is was she dishonest with the managing broker? Was she dishonest with the compliance staff? And she was. This is much more than then suggested on the briefs from the other side that if she's not supposed to show a property wearing jeans, and then she shows up and doesn't tell the managing broker she'd been wearing jeans, but rather shows up at the managing broker and represents that she'd been wearing clothing that more appropriate. This goes to her relationship with other people.
And okay, but that was where I was going with the question. You're now putting degrees on the dishonesty. Is that appropriate, or is it? I hate to use the jeans argument, but assuming that because it was in the briefs, would that be a basis for action?
It would, Mr. Chief. Under the strict letter of the law, yes, it would be. But realistically, is that something that would give rise to a commission proceeding? I would say unlikely. I mean, I can't imagine that. But when you have in the relationship, you know, this managing broker, the buck stops with him on anybody working under him. If he's got 10 agents, I mean, the individual agents can get in trouble, but the managing broker gets in equal trouble. And the statute I cited in my brief reflects that. So is it important for him to have a staff that's working in a proper manner? Absolutely.
And counsel, let's say that Ms. St. Pierre got picked up for shoplifting. How would your client deal with that? Is that dishonesty outside the profession that would qualify for the discipline that we're talking about here today?
Judge Long, I would say yes, it would. Then the question is, would there be a proceeding that would be brought before it? Would that come to the attention if someone brought it to the attention? Because there have been licensees before who have committed criminal violations, and it has been brought to the attention of the Real Estate Commission, and it's outside of the work they've done. And does it bear upon their fitness? Does it bear upon whether or not they're complying with their professional responsibility? Yes, it does. Do all of those ultimately end up in proceedings before the commission? No, they don't. The effort of Ms. St. Pierre was a shortcut to get her where she wanted to be. And it's inconsistent with her professional responsibility. As I've suggested, while there might be degrees of the wrongdoing relative to what type of discipline or whether the proceeding would ultimately end up before the Real Estate Commission, the statute doesn't limit the dishonesty to dealings within the profession. In this case, I think the court could, if they so chose, because this was a dishonesty within the activities of the profession. And Administrative Law Judge Brady found that in her findings, that it was within the pursuit of her professional licensure where the dishonesty occurred. This was more than a case where she signed on behalf of a client. This was a case where she represented to a compliance staff that it was the client who had signed. If she had wanted to proceed in an appropriate manner, she could have signed Bob Ryder by Lindsay Ryder Rapp, or she could have indicated power of attorney, but she knew that wasn't going to meet with the rules that had been established within the agency. Just real briefly on expenses, the court didn't decide the question of expenses. Because it didn't have to get that far and didn't get that far. We nonetheless raised it for this court's consideration should the court deem it appropriate. In this case, the license suspension was held in abeyance pending completion of the courses and payment of the expenses. So if she had chosen not to pay the expenses and not to fulfill the courses, then her license would be suspended. And there would not be a money judgment against her for payment of these expenses. So it gives her the opportunity, number one. Number two, I believe this court on other occasions has indicated that there are circumstances where attorney's fees can be recovered. And when the statute speaks to, and it says, this court says when there is a specific statute, 126.29.1 allows an agency to recover all or part of its actual expenses. So it goes beyond merely taxation of costs. It allows recovery of expenses. The last issue dealt with the question of the fine. There was a $1,000 fine that was also included as part of the payment that had to be done, or else her license would be suspended. The statute says there can be $2,500 worth of fines. There was an earlier $1,000 fine and this second $1,000, so it's less than the $2,500 limit. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryder. Mr. Barker, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, and Judge Long, it's good to be here this morning. May it please the court and counsel. My firm, Barker Wilson Law Firm from Rapid City and Belle Fouche, has the honor of representing Ms. St. Pier in this matter. We've represented her through the administrative proceeding as all the way through the appeal you're hearing today. What we're asking is that you affirm Judge Eklund in his decision and that you look at this case in the same way that Judge Eklund did. And that is that he looked at the framework of the complaint, the formal complaint issued by the South Dakota Real Estate Commission, and determined based upon the evidence that was presented at the hearing whether it fit within the definition of the wrongs that the commission has identified in its complaint. It's very important that the framework of the complaint be identified. This is a professional license that is at stake here. And this court has said, in the Schramm case most recently, the Schramm case in any other professional license, whether it be for real estate or insurance or dentistry or medicine, if a license or modification of a license is at stake, then the allegations against the licensee need to be stated specifically. And there cannot be any implied allegations that are not fairly litigated.
Well, let me ask you a question about that, because I didn't see where you objected to evidence that she was dishonest in her dealings with compliance staff. If that's the case, wasn't that issue tried by implication?
Your Honor, the answer is no. The issue of compliance or dishonesty with the compliance staff was not fairly litigated at the hearing level.
Well, there was certainly lots of evidence about it.
Well,
you didn't object on the basis that this wasn't pled.
Precisely. If you look at the briefs, in fact, the Real Estate Commission cited my testimony or my opening statement actually on pages 8 and 9 of the transcript. And if you look at that, I stated that the allegations before the board, before the commission and hearing examiner Hillary Brady, were precisely those subsections of 3621A71, subsections 15 and 32. And I said, those are the issues. Later, after the transcript was available, Ms. Brady, hearing examiner Brady, took those statements and morphed them into, well, it appears, apparently, impliedly, there's not enough evidence to support violation of subsection 15. The commission conceded that there wasn't a violation of subsection 32. So on subsection 15, we're going to concentrate on the issue of dishonesty or fraud. And so the answer to your question, Justice Sinter, is absolutely no. It wasn't by implication. If it were by implication, this court has said it repeatedly for a number of cases over the years that it's a professional license. There can't be implicit contest of an allegation that is not explicitly stated by the agency that's bringing the action. And that wasn't brought here. I think it's important if you look at, in fact, look at the formal complaint. It says under item number 4, that pursuant to the office policy at First Choice Realty, and I'm paraphrasing, she needed a release of a listing agreement signed by all three sellers. Then going to item number 5, That defendant did not have prior written authorization to sign on behalf of any of the sellers. And then it goes on to cite the statute that I just cited. And I won't repeat that here, but what Judge Eklund said is, wait, if you look at the framework of the complaint and match that with the violation of the statute that the commission is alleging, it doesn't work. It doesn't fit. It doesn't rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence. That was the basis. Justice Severson hit it in the question that he asked Mr. Ryder. And that is, isn't the issue whether violation of an internal policy rises to the level of a statutory violation of dishonesty or fraud? Judge Eklund said, no, it does not. There wasn't clear and convincing evidence. So the framework of the allegations against Smith St. Pierre have evolved over the time. When this first happened, I think it's very important to put this in proper context. Ms. St. Pierre was a successful realtor with First Realty. She was recruited by them because of her success. The evidence in the transcript indicates that she was the top seller of the agency. She had represented Mr. Pagan before and had a history of a relationship with him. This listing, it's important to know, and it wasn't hit on in the first presentation. This listing consisted of two listings, actually, two different listings, both of which had expired. The first listing was for a bare lot. The second listing was for a house that Mr. Pagan could build on the lot. The transaction closed on the first listing, the bare lot. The transaction, or the listing for the house that was to be constructed, had expired. And also, obviously, by fact, the house was never built. So the closing took place, and it is true, and it is accurate to say that Ms. St. Pierre did not know about Mr. Pagan's partners in California until it came time for the closing. Then she involved them in the closing transaction, and everything was fine. And then it was after that transaction closed that the compliance staff of First Realty said, wait a minute, there's nothing here in the document that there has been a release of the second listing. Well, that is unnecessary because the lot was sold. Secondly, the listing had expired. But nevertheless, she called Mr. Pagan up, and who testified, by the way, at the hearing, and said, Bob, you need to come back. We have a document on the second listing. She explained her circumstance. And Mr. Pagan, as he put it in his testimony in colorful language, said he's not coming back, and that it was unnecessary, and that that they didn't need it. And so Ms. St. Pierre, who had acrimonious relationships with Mr. Koenigkamp, the testimony, as you saw from the record, Mr. Karn verified that this became little more than an internal dispute. In fact, at one point, he suggested that this needs to be handled, but it's an internal matter. And then on the day that Ms. St. Pierre announced that she was leaving First Realty, on that day, that very same day, the commission got a communication from Mr. Koenigkamp suggesting is not a strong enough word, asking them why this wasn't being prosecuted. So up until that point in time, it was a matter that appeared to be, and that's subjective, of course, but it appeared to be that it was a matter that was going to be left to lay.
All right. Well, Mr. Barker, what about the language that deals with dishonesty arising within or without the pursuit of the license? Is that the crux of what we're talking here about here?
Dishonesty within the, yes, Your Honor. If, first off, it needs to be pointed out that Chapters 36, 21A is meant to protect the consumer. That's a body of law that the legislature has enacted and the commission enforces to protect the public. And so the answer to that question, and Judge Eklund, I think, found that key, is that there wasn't anything here that was dishonest or fraudulent as to the public. The point about the Leonard case is that no harm, no foul. Well, that's true. That's very true with respect to the public. But this was an internal policy that arguably didn't even apply here. But because of a personality conflict, she was forced to do it. Could she have done it better? Absolutely. Did she violate an internal company policy? Yes.
Did she admit dishonesty?
Yes. In the transcript, Justice Wilbur, what she said is, and to put that in proper context, I asked her the question, and I said, did you feel like you were dishonest? Well, with Matt, yes. The explanation to that was because of this internal policy. It wasn't as to a member of the public.
Well, why shouldn't the case be over at that point?
Because she wasn't dishonest in terms of the statute, Your Honor. And that's one point. The second point is, that's not the framework of the complaint, the form of complaint.
Well, again, did you object to any evidence at any time on the ground that it exceeded the allegations of the complaint?
Yes. I did before the hearing. I sent a letter with my affidavit and said, listen, I want to make sure. First off, in all fairness and in all candor, my concern was that the involuntary compliance, that was going to be an issue in the hearing. And because I said that's not the framework of the complaint. Number two is I want to make sure that we confine our argument and our evidence to the issues of the complaint. This was an administrative hearing, and I have to say that Mr. Ryder and I did our best to get along because Judge Brady did say at the beginning, this is a rather informal process. We're going to try to get the evidence in. And I did, and Your Honor, that doesn't excuse lack of objection if I felt it was outside the bounds of what had been in the complaint. But until Ms. Brady issued her decision in this case, I had no idea that she was going to the next step, actually something completely different than the complaint. So that issue did not become clear until after the decision was rendered. And, of course, our appeal to Judge Eklund, that was in not only our first brief, but also our second brief. We briefed that rigorously. Have I answered your question?
Well, I still don't have a good feeling as far as whether you preserved a trial by implication. As far as, for instance, the evidence of whiteout, what could that have related to except dishonesty with respect to compliance?
It's because
so did you object to that?
No, I did not object to it. The short answer is no, because the evidence was the rest of the story is she had a staff person in there with her saying, "I'm never going to meet Matt Kohnekamp's criteria in this. I can't." So I'm going to sign my client's names. She had a staff person there who witnessed it. And so it wasn't as though it was something that she did under the table and nobody knew about it. One of the staff people at First Realty did. And again, I say that it was a violation of company policy. She understands that. But it was not violation of state law. And it doesn't rise to the level of some type of modification, suspension, or revocation of a professional license. If particularly, I want to emphasize this, if particularly that wasn't the framework of the commission's formal complaint, and it never was. And so that's the important part about this. When they took Ms. St. Pierre in to interrogate her, and the testimony is that took place over an hour to an hour and a half, we have 20 minutes of tape, they weren't able to explain what happened to the rest of the tape, but in it, the tape does reveal that she was quite candid with everybody that was seated there, including the two attorneys who accused her of a felony. They said, this is a class 5 felony. You are going to go to jail for this. She was quite distraught, and she said, I did sign it, but here's why. I was left in a vice between Mr. Pagan saying, not only is he not coming back, but he'll probably never come back, and a compliance for something that was even absolutely unnecessary.
Well, how do you explain her claim that she'd emailed it to them? That's why there weren't fax markings on it.
Your Honor, the transcript and the testimony isn't well developed as to whether she did or did not email it. My belief here, and again, I can't cite to the record to say that, is that she did email it, but she did not obtain their signatures. She was quite...
But she represented to them that this was a this was an email document. That's why there were no fax markings. And that's not true.
I think her testimony was that she emailed it to the Pagans to the Hoffmans, so that they were aware of the situation. But both the Hoffmans and Mr. Pagan signed written verified statements afterwards saying she had our authority. We told her to sign whatever is necessary. We instructed her to.
What about Mr. Ryder's argument that she never obtained after the fact authority as far as a woman in California? That Pagan didn't have authority to authorize her signature.
It's a red herring. Here's the situation. Mr. Pagan testified at the hearing that he had authority to sign whatever documents were necessary for any transaction up to $600,000, and that he had the authority of his partners in California to do so. And they verified that he had the authority to sign their documents in the written statement that was part of the evidence in this case.
As I recall, he admitted in his testimony that he didn't have authority to authorize her signature. Didn't that come in testimonial evidence?
Your Honor, I think the testimony was that Mr. Pagan had the authority to sign on both of his partner's behalf. And they certainly confirmed that after the fact. So.
I'm kind of slow. I'm looking at the formal complaint. And in paragraph 8 and 9, 3621A71, sub 15 is alleged, and then that the defendant signed. Tell me how the evidence in front of the hearing examiner was outside of that again.
Here is the complaint, of course, has to be read together, Justice Wilbur. But first off, it was the hearing up, Commission alleged that it was a violation of an office policy, and the violation of that office policy was they didn't have prior written authority. And that prior written authority violated subsection 15. That was the allegation. Then, hearing officer Brady changed that and said, well, wait a minute, the violation of the office policy is the charge, not the fact that you didn't have prior written authorization to sign Mr. Pagan and the Hoffman's name. That's how it changed. And that changes the framework of the complaint. In other words, sections 5 or paragraphs 5 and 6 do not equate to a violation of subsection 15. And that's what Judge Eklund found when he issued his decision in this case. He states, under the clearly erroneous standard, an administrative agency will only be reversed on the factual issue if, after reviewing all the evidence. Here's what I think was key about that, and that's in the findings that were adopted by Judge Eklund, and that is that Ms. Brady specifically found that there was forgery. She specifically found that there was forgery, that the signing of those names without prior written authorization amounted to forgery under finding 15. That is clearly erroneous. Forgery is a specific intent crime, and there was no evidence at the administrative level that there was any specific intent by Ms. St. Pierre to violate any of the protections offered by subsection 15 or for that matter, subsection 32. So, that in and of itself shows, I think that was the proof that Judge Eklund wanted, is that this doesn't arise to the level of forgery. She had prior approval, and that prior approval was...
She didn't have prior written approval.
That's true.
So that part of the complaint's correct.
That part of the part of the complaint of written, but she had verbal. And Judge Eklund said it's not material whether it was written or verbal. The statute doesn't require that. The fact is that she was authorized. That's the important part. And all three of the people whose names she signed stated that. She had specific authority. In fact, it was directed by Mr. Pagan to sign. I'm very quickly coming to the end of my time, and so I need to get to the issue of attorney's fees. This court has said repeatedly that in order to award attorney's fees, there has to be a specific grant of authority. This commission does not have that specific grant of authority. There is no case in South Dakota that we could find that was on point. The related cases are those cases where there has been a continuance in a trial matter, where the judge that's sitting on the trial court and there's a continuance on the eve of trial, there's costs that have been incurred by the other party. There's specific statutory authority that in light of justice, like judges, all of you have been trial judges, know that you can grant terms, which could include attorney's fees. No such specific authority is granted to the South Dakota Real Estate Commission. If you allow attorney's fees in this case, that's setting a brand new precedence in this state that has never been established in any interpretive law and certainly not authorized by the statute. And so we believe that the writer firm, as good a job as they've done in this case, doesn't get their fees paid by Ms. St. Pierre. Also, it's just a bit of an inherent
conflict. Your time has expired, Mr. Barker. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chief Justice.
Mr. Wright, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Please, the court. Ms. St. Pierre could have gone back to the compliance staff and said, I don't believe this document's necessary, and here's why. Did she do that? No. She just decided, I'm going to sign the names. I'm going to not try to discuss this issue with the compliance staff. And rather, now when she comes to the hearing, she suggests that this all relates to some zealousness from the managing broker. And I, with the court's permission, I just would like to read a little bit from what the administrative law judge said about her attempt to deflect the issues involved. And this is in the appendix we attached to our brief on page 6. And this is Administrative Law Judge Brady saying, licensee took her actions to induce the compliance staff to sign off on the transaction. Whether she did this to receive her commission check or just to get them off her back is not clear. Licensee's argument that the real culprit in this matter is Matt Konenkamp's unbridled zealousness is self-serving and offensive. Licensee made the choice to be dishonest and represent the signatures as the Huffmans and Pagans, even though she knew this was not allowed. She was not forthright in saying she was signing for them or that she had permission to sign. This is deceit and is very squarely fits within the requirements of the statute constituting dishonest. So did she speak to the question of dishonesty? Yes. The fraud issue, and we're here today because this actions of Ms. St. Pierre were dishonest, and we believe that inconsistent with her professional obligation.
What about the argument of Mr. Barker on the complaint, that this was not specifically addressed in the complaint and that the charges really evolved as the proceeding evolved?
The complaint specifically cited that statute, subpart 15, which speaks to dishonesty.
Okay, but is it talking about which dishonesty? To the compliance staff or in the filing of the representation as to oral or document?
Whether it was written authority or...
Right.
In the complaint, yes, we referenced the question of whether or not the authority was written, and there was no written authority. But beyond that, the requirement within the agency was you don't sign other people's name. The whole operative set of facts, this whole case revolved around whether or not she was supposed to be signing these names. They said, yes, she could because she had this implied authority, although I would ask you to look, and I believe the transcript shows she never had authority from Mrs. Huffman beforehand, and no argument that even she did. So the gravamen of the case, the operative set of facts, all relate to this. Did the complaint specifically say this conduct of this particular nature? No, it didn't specifically say that she was dishonest because she signed their names. It said that she signed their names without authority. and prior authority, or and I don't have it in front of me, so if I'm a little mistaken on that, that's awfully close. But even beyond that, yeah, Mr. Barker did raise it. He let the case go forward without objection relative to the evidence that came in, and I'm not trying to say that was right or wrong. I'm just as a statement of fact. He did an excellent job for his client. Then beyond that, all of the evidence came in. Then when this was appealed by him to Judge Eklin, yes, he raised that issue again. Judge Eklin never brought that up in his decision. Mr. Barker never filed a notice of review relative to that issue. We would argue that it's not before the court. There was no notice of review on that. Mr. Barker was well satisfied with the result he had from Judge Eklin, and he didn't seek to go further to bring that issue before you. If he had done that, then it would be ripe for consideration. It's not ripe. It's waived. I would also argue that the question of dishonesty, in the brief, there was never an argument made with citations that said that this conduct of Ms. St. Pierre was not dishonest. And frankly, they couldn't be, because her own admission bound her to the dishonest nature of her actions. The important issue is really the obligation she owes, and Mr. Barker suggests she owes it to the public. Well, she does, but she also owed it to her managing broker. Truly, the way the license statutes are set up in real estate law, the managing broker has the responsibility for those people who work under him. And if, for instance, in the legal field, if there was a lawyer associate, the lawyer associate stands alone if he or she does something wrong and appears in front of the disciplinary board. In this particular case, and there's been numerous occasions where the commission has brought a complaint against a licensee and also included the managing broker, who is responsible for that person and responsible to see that that person acts within the confines of the statute. The other items that Mr. Barker brought up that I want to touch on just briefly, be mindful from our perspective of the attorney's fees argument. The statute allows expenses to be recovered. But beyond that, the language of the order says that your license is suspended for X period of time, but we're going to hold that suspension in abeyance if you do several things. Complete these education courses, pay a fine of $1,000, and reimburse the commission for these expenses. There was not a money judgment assessed against her. Rather, it was her choice to proceed in the manner. If she didn't want her license suspended for this period of time, she could do 1, 2, and 3. So I don't believe a decision from this court saying that, yes, attorney's fees can be recovered as expenses is inconsistent with the law that currently exists. I would also mention to the court that in the Leonard case, this court discussed at some length the allocation of attorney's fees, because in that case there were two defendants, two licensees, and the court was concerned that one of the licensees had to pay all the expenses, which included a significant amount of attorney's fees. And this court said that there ought to be, sent it back and saying that there ought to be a determination as far as which party would pay which portion of these expenses. Mr. Barker raises the issue, rightfully so, that was not directly raised as an issue in that particular case, but it was certainly discussed by this court with the recognition that this is something that is within the confines of, as the statute says, within the confines of part of all or part of the actual expenses incurred by the commission in its proceeding. The document itself, not only did she not raise it with the compliance staff that that I don't think this is necessary. Let's look at this again. There were two documents they wanted initially. They indicated that one of those was not necessary, so they backed away from that one. This wasn't the managing broker that suggested she have to sign this. This was two individuals working within the agency that were specifically designed to make sure that the agents working within the company complied with company policy and complied with law and treated the customers in the manner that they were supposed to treat the customers. Her choice to sign someone else's name is confirmed, the wrongful nature of it was confirmed by her own testimony. Mr. Barker first started asking the question of her. I objected because I thought it was self-serving. I presume she'd answer and say that she didn't feel dishonest. Mr. Barker came back to it, and at that time she said, yes, I was dishonest to Mr. Koenigkamp. We believe this case rises and falls upon her admission. Her admission is such that she understands that she violated not just company policy, but she violated the statute. She was dishonest within or without her license privilege, and the decision of Judge Upton should be reversed. The decision of the Real Estate Commission should be reinstated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryder. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and we'll conduct a rule hearing.